This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 22nd of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. We have a clothing and construction theme for you on this week's show. Unlikely bedfellows, you might think, but fear not, all will be revealed. Coming up over the next hour, as the men's fashion collections wind up in Paris, Aisha Spears delivers her expert roundup of sartorial proceedings from the French capital. Meanwhile, over in Munich, our Milan correspondent rolls up his sleeves and gets busy at BAU, the world's largest trade fair for the construction industry.
The German building industry and construction industry is definitely very strong. Big advantage is that we have many building companies owned and run by families.
And over in San Francisco, Alistair G meets with Deborah Sterling, founder of Goldieblocks, a new toy soon to launch, starring a girl who loves to build.
I was once a little girl, and I studied product design. I can design a product for little girls, and it just hit me like an epiphany, and I knew it was what I was born to do.
More on that shortly. Elsewhere, we drop in on the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, talk fashion upcycling in Berlin, and back in Paris, our man Tom Burgess Watson flexes his olfactory muscles and learns how to create a fragrance from scratch. That's all to come on the next hour here on Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. We begin this week's Section D in Gay Paris. It was an eventful week in the French capital. The design world descended for the biannual Maisonnette Objet trade show, which we'll be bringing our verdict from in next week's show. They jostled for space with the fashion crowd, there to conclude the latest round of men's collections. As if this influx of extra bodies wasn't difficult enough to cope with, the city had a generous dumping of snow too. Trotting around in her snow boots with her microphone and notebook was our very own Aisha Spears, and here's what she found.
Having pounded the pavement of London, Florence and Milan, the international gang of menswear buyers, designers and press battled with the snow in Paris last week to finish off their European tour. More relaxed in atmosphere and tailoring than Milan and less frantic than Florence's pity show, Paris's menswear offering is a mix of catwalk shows from brands like Louis Vuitton and Hermès, alongside trade shows displaying the work of smaller brands. Last season, I met Antoine Floch, a co-founder of the relatively new Man trade show. I caught up with him again to see how he planned on controlling the show's success.
First is because Romain, Olivier and me are three different persons with three different personalities. So we all bring something different to the show. And then we said no this season to like around 40 brands. So again, because we don't want to grow too fast. And then we try to have a nice venue and be... It became kind of a family here, you know. All the brands are, you know, they are our clients, but they're also becoming friends season after season. And because we help them with their business. The idea, again, with men, because we are small, we have more capacity to welcome the buyers properly, thank them for coming, go around the show with them, introduce them to new brands. Or, you know, if a brand is like, oh, I really want to see this shop, I really want to sell to this shop, we want to be able to do this. And if we would have like 150 brands, we won't be able to do that the way we do it now. So I'm very happy about the brand list this season. And all the brands have their place at Man. And I think now we arrive to a point where this brand list will be the base of Man for the next season. So because we're changing the venue next season, we're going to have new brands. But I think all the brands here will be there again next season. And if we manage to, you know, have some brands at the show that do the appointments, is a nice setup, but because of us they open new accounts in new markets, this is you know, what we want to do.
One of the brands showing at Man is The Hillside, a Brooklyn-based accessories label run by brothers Emile and Sandy Corsello. They told me why they came to Paris.
We just felt like Paris is a great place for us to show, to sort of, I don't know, foster relationships and sort of just get our stuff outside of the U.S. and also get us out of the U.S. so that we can see what's going on, talk to people that aren't Americans, and just get a feel for things.
It's been great so far. It's been really energetic, and we have three distributors for Europe actually, and two of them are here at the show with us. So our purpose at the show is a little bit less actively selling things than it is when we do the show in New York. So it's a little bit more of a like relationship thing where we're meeting shop owners who we've never met before, or we only get to see twice a year.
And who have you noticed coming in, either in terms of nationality or specific stores who have been in full force today?
One thing I noticed is that already on the first day, a few U.S. shops that we sell to have been here, and we've never seen them in Paris before. Union Made from San Francisco and Mohawk General Store from L.A. both came through this morning, and they're great friends of ours, so just it's nice to bump into them in Paris.
Across the river at the Capsule Show, I spoke to Stefano Ambrosini, owner of Italian outerwear brand Museum. I asked him why he feels it's important to show both at Pitti and in Paris.
The difference between Pitti and Capsule is the selection of the brands and the point of view of what is fashion now for the young guys and not only. So for us, they are both interesting because they are different. So we can mix, our product is able to be mixed with a more classical look, like Italian look, but also it can be contemporary, like for all these brands that we have here in Capsule. The strength of this brand is that this can be double choice, you know? So classic and also jeanswear or outerwear, or more military look, more fashionable. The people of a fashion system are more or less, they goes around all the sport and trade show. But we have seen that here in Paris there are more Japanese people, and fashion is can be much more and more the same worldwide. If the style if the style is good, the buyers, they have to be in all these trade shows. For us, very important, okay, Italy is important because it's our country, and then we have Germany with Switzerland, Austria, and now we start very good in Benelux. And good contacts also from France and from Scandinavia and north of Europe. Then Korea for Asia, more popular than Japan, but we have here in Paris, we started very good contacts. And then next week we will be in Project New York. So we hope to develop also the business in Canada and US.
Two of the most colorful buyers walking around Capsule were Spencer Lemon and Todd Barquette of San Francisco's Union Made. They managed to spare a couple of minutes to talk about their experience in town.
We found some very nice things, right?
We found a number of nice things, yeah. The nice thing, too, about this show is that it's a little bit more mellow and casual than, say, New York is. So you can take your time and you don't feel quite as inundated with all of the scene that's going on.
Yeah. It feels a little more adult as well. Like, it's just a little more cleaned up and presented in a different way.
And so who are you seeing here that you don't see in New York?
A couple European brands, for sure. North Sea, for one. Margaret Howell, we get to see here. A number of the brands do show in the States.
Yeah. But everyone's become really international. It's funny. It's like everyone is everywhere you go. You see somebody. But I think, you can be a little more thoughtful here. I think than New York, it's not as hurried. You can take your time and kind of breathe a little bit. So I think things just happen to look a little different here too, visually. So it kind of inspires you a little bit in a different way.
And a lot of people at Pitti were saying that the Japanese were really kind of supporting them. The Japanese buyers are out in force.
It's in shocking. Force.
It's amazing.
They blow
we're
my mind.
We're very envious.
Yeah, they're very envious, and they blow my mind because they're just everywhere, and they're so focused and so like intense. Like it's amazing.
Their buying teams are. I mean,
that is
a whole
new level.
That is really inspiring.
Yeah, they're inspiring.
Actually.
Is that why you decided to have a budget this season?
Maybe. We go to Tokyo in March, so
we'll try
to save a little bit for that. But yeah, no. We know, we respect the Japanese, just they're the apple of our eye.
As the men and women of menswear finally begin to catch their flights home, Paris airports will be abuzz with a multitude of languages. But if the industry's trade shows were anything to go by, there will be a lot more Japanese spoken than anything else. For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Aisha Spears.
Thank you very much, Aisha, or perhaps I should say arigato. And I do hope you returned safely to New York, unhindered by the dusting of snow that's brought French and English airports to a standstill. Up next, we're off to Berlin to take a look at the other end of the fashion industry, finding out what happens to clothes at the end of their life, and discover how they might be reincarnated.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those just joining us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Though Milan and Paris steal the limelight, it was also Berlin Fashion Week last week, a younger stop on the fashion circuit that's growing in stature season on season. We gave up our seat on the front row in Berlin, though, and headed to an unlikely venue that shows what happens at the other end of fashion's life cycle. It's called the Upcycling Fashion Store, how very Berlin, and it's where your clothes might well end up after you've thrown them out. We sent our reporter, Gina McEwen, to find out more.
This is a dress by Steinwider. She's also an Austrian designer. And for this project, she used old socks to turn them into dresses and tops.
That's Louise Barsch. We're standing in a fashion store she co-founded a year ago here in Berlin. And right in front of us, it's a dress made from socks.
In the first moment you see it, you don't think about socks. It's the second look. Some people just don't realize they're standing there. And then they're like, after 5 minutes, ah, it sucks. Even people, they come in, you think, oh, those are like fancy people, you know, maybe they wouldn't wear it, but usually people really admire what is here, what is in the shop.
This shop isn't quite like the other fashion boutiques you'll find around here. We're in Mitte, an area of Berlin that's now the place you go if you want local designers and high-end fashion. But this particular shop specializes in something different. It's called Upcycling Fashion.
You have a material that is supposed to be, let's call it waste, or that is, yeah, it's not used anymore, and you turn it into a product with a higher value. Recycling would be another word, but recycling is usually has some kind of negative approach.
And there's two kinds of upcycling fashion.
In upcycling, we talk about pre- and post-consumer waste. Pre-consumer waste is industrial leftovers, like cut-offs, end-of-row fabrics, things that are left over from old collections, things like that. And post-consumer waste is what has been used, like old clothes, secondhand fashion.
So basically, when a big company cuts out its design from a huge roll of fabric, there are these leftover bits that normally get chucked out. These bits are pre-consumer waste, and some designers use these offcuts to make new clothes. Anything that's been worn or used before, and it's made into something new, that's post-consumer waste, like the dress made of old socks. And once you know this, you want to take a closer look at everything in the shop, because nothing is quite what you thought it was.
Carpenter's pants, carpenter's jackets into new, very classical suit.
So these were used, these were worn by mm-hmm. carpenters?
Yes. He's working with all the visual damage that you can see that the work has done to this material before. And he's working with that as part of the design, which is really interesting. I mean, these, they actually have a history and they have worked like hell, I guess.
What are these over here?
This is
got jewelry. See, so you do jewelry as well.
Yeah, they look like gold, and the brand is called Old Gold. She's also a Berlin-based designer, and she uses Nespresso cups. Nespresso cups, everybody knows, George Clooney is making the advertisement for them, but they are kind of very, I don't know, people are very critical about them, like, at least in the eco scene, because they produce a lot of waste, right? They have, like, for one coffee, you use one of these little metal cups and
you chuck it away.
And you chuck it away, and she's turning them into jewelry, which nobody ever, like, really realized in the first moment what it was.
They're all different colors.
I think every color is a different taste of coffee, actually.
This is a multi-flavored necklace.
Yes, kind of.
There's even one upcycling designer who makes dresses from old prisoners' clothes. But how does someone go from sketching at fashion school to going out and collecting prisoners' shirts for their collections?
A lot of friends of mine, they consume fashion like food. I don't know, they buy so much. They had all these leftovers. I said, yeah, don't throw it away. Rather, like, give it to me. Maybe I can do something from it. And that's when I started using old garments to create something new, just because I thought it would be a waste of I don't know, why would you throw away, like, the jumper that is still really good, maybe has a little hole somewhere, so I turned it into a dress or whatever, like this kind of thing. Then, of course, when you study fashion, you get to see what's behind fashion industry, which is kind of awful. All this pollution going on, all this, like how they treat the workers in the third world and wherever. So there's so much that you start to realize what is bad about fashion. So of course there was the idea to do something else, to start something, to work against them, kind of.
So if upcycling designers think this way about the rest of the industry, what does the industry think about upcycling?
Hello, my name is Sebastiano. I'm a fashion stylist and I work as a store manager as well at Butterfly Soulfire in Berlin.
I spoke with Sebastiano in this boutique just down the road from the upcycle store. He sat surrounded by tiny dresses made from leather and feathers that looked super chic and very expensive. He flicked through a couple of the photos I'd taken of the sock dress and that Nespresso cup necklace.
The concept of upcycling or recycling can be exciting, but most of the time all the products or all the pieces I see, they don't thrill me at all. And most of the time it's just like, oh, it's funny, but I don't want to have it. Or it looks like trashy, or a product that maybe someone who's from 12 to 16 would buy because he thinks it's fun.
Sebastiano told me he admired famous designers when they do it well. But the danger is that it's easy to get upcycling wrong and make it look ugly. A couple of other designers I spoke to in the area said similar things, that upcycling is a great idea, as long as the clothes are beautiful.
It fits in the fashion world because there are people who appreciate or even who like the way they reinvent the pieces. I just most of the time don't like the colors. It looks, in German we would say it looks too öko, like not fancy, you know?
This may be Sebastiano's take on these clothes, but what he's getting at is that fashion comes down to taste, style, and skill. And the same goes for upcycling. But because it's such a small part of the industry, the guys who run the upcycling store think it's important to encourage new talent.
And I dye them with natural dyes.
This is Carmen. She's one of three design graduates who was asked by the upcycling store to exhibit work in the shop window during Berlin Fashion Week. Carmen's telling me about her collection. They're button-up shirts made from old bed sheets.
Because cotton uses a lot of water, it's a natural fiber, but it costs a lot in terms of resources.
Next to where Carmen is standing, there were these piles of folded bed sheets on a table. She tells me she sourced all of these sheets from women in Berlin who advertised on this particular website. They wanted stuff in exchange for their old bed sheets. So Carmen gave them coffee, bread, even toothpaste for their sheets.
Yeah, different things. That they were looking for, that they wanted, that they asked it.
Hanging from the collar of all of Carmen's shirts is this folded piece of paper. Inside, there's complex drawings she's done of a water molecule and the world's river systems. These are the stencils that are printed onto all of her shirts. There's also information in there about cotton farming.
So why are you putting this information in?
Because people don't know how much water cotton costs.
And it says also there that there's chemical dyes and things
there's
that you've got there.
There's chemical dyes. The water get dirty. And before the chemicals die, there are like pesticides, stuff for the earth and other chemicals that they use to open the seeds. All the different
things. For upcycling designers like Carmen, the concept behind their clothes goes beyond just fashion. It's about education, it's a lifestyle choice, and it's about sustainability. And Louise, the co-founder of the upcycling store in Berlin, knows better than anyone that like other areas of sustainability, wider acceptance is a slow process.
There is a lot of people that do care, and more people care. So this is super cool, but still like such a small percentage of the whole. Yeah, for me, the future would be awesome. Like every normal brand has like an upcycling designer, right? Working with their leftovers and stuff like that would be awesome. I think we're now the generation of designers that's going to work on that, that's going to change it, and that this is going to be more like a normal thing.
Is it your life now? Is this what you want to do?
Yeah. How can you stop being an an upcycling designer? Because wherever you go, you see something, like you see an old, I don't know, jacket lying in the street, somebody lost it or somebody didn't want it anymore, and you already like build up this awesome dress up from it in your head. It's just like an addiction.
And that's how you see the world now, is it?
That's very much how I see the world.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Gina McEwen.
Thank you very much for that, Gina. We wear them every day. Without them, we'd probably have constant blisters, frostbite, and very ugly feet. Yes, we're talking about shoes, our feet's guardian angels and protectors. Toronto's Batter Shoe Museum celebrates the design and innovation over the last few thousand years of shoes from our history. And Mar Sellers, Our Lady in Toronto, visited the museum this week to check in with their current exhibition on Parisian master designer Roger Vivier.
In terms of our most famous shoes or most popular shoes, I would say our Elton John boots are the ones that seem to get reproduced quite a bit. People love artifacts with provenance, right? And so it's, whether it's Napoleon socks or Queen Victoria shoes, people definitely are drawn to the stories that they immediately recognize within the footwear. We also have some gorgeous Roger Vivier. His shoes tend to be quite popular. And so I'm sure everybody who comes to the museum leaves with a different favorite.
Elizabeth Selmahack, senior curator of the Batter Shoe Museum. Toronto's Batter Shoe Museum was founded in 1995 by Mrs. Sonia Batter, wife of shoemaker Thomas Batter. It holds one of the largest shoe collections in the world, including 13,000 artifacts ranging from 4,500 years old to the most contemporary shoes off today's fashion runways. With three contemporary galleries, the museum alternates exhibitions on view, specializing in everything from sneakers to Native American moccasins. Currently, they have an intensive exhibition on Roger Vivier, a man who designed some of the most famous shoes of our time, credited with inventing the thigh-high boot, the pilgrim buckle, and the stiletto as we know it today. Elizabeth Selmahack on Vivier's beginnings.
Roger Vivier was orphaned at 10, and he was raised by family friends. Eventually, he thought he would go onto the stage. It turns out that he had very little talent on stage, and so a family friend kindly offered him a job at his shoe factory. And at the shoe factory, Vivier was schooled in all of the different stages of footwear production. And he decided at that point that shoe design was really something that he could focus on. And in some ways, he had the Midas touch. As a very young man, straight out of really learning the process of shoemaking, he landed some wonderful contracts. He attracted the eye of Josephine Baker, of Schiaparelli, and he also began to design some shoes for a German leather company. And it wasn't until just a few years ago that the Leather Museum in Offenbach, Germany, realized that they had those original prototypes. They'd never been exhibited before, and so they're here on view. And what's interesting about looking at these shoes, they're all from the 30s, is that we all know who Vivier became, but you can see him already in this early material. During the war, World War II that is, he moved to New York City to work for Herman Delman. And while he was in the United States, he patented everything he drew. And so I found a patent for him from 1942 that shows a very, very large pilgrim buckle. Right. He transformed fashion in the 60s with that pilgrim buckle, but here it is already in 1942. Here we're looking at his pullovers. These are the shoes that are designed in three-dimensional form before they go into production, and you can see his artistic sense, his desire for a kind of perfection of the foot, most clearly in these shoes that ultimately are not intended to be worn. They will be fabricated and made for wear, but they'll be altered in that process. Mm-hmm. And so it is interesting to look at these pieces because you get a sense of Vivier as a sculptor, as an artist. And in fact, he trained as a sculptor before going and working at the shoe factory. And I think that his artistry is something that we shouldn't deny in looking at his shoes. At the end of his life, he said that the sculpture of his life were the shoes that he made. And I think that there is a great deal of beauty and balance in the shoes that he designs. There is a famous Vivier story where a woman bought a pair of shoes and she returned the next day and some of the paillettes and beads were missing. And she was greeted with the exclamation, "But madam, you wore them." So the question is, were they ever intended to be worn? I think they were intended to be worn, but I think everyone recognized that they were very special shoes and they were certainly not for doing anything but sitting pretty.
Speaking of special shoes, during the 1950s, Vivier designed shoes for Christian Dior, and it was at this time that he worked on his stiletto.
So many people do credit Vivier with having invented the stiletto. He did not invent it. If we define the stiletto as a steel heel, that award goes to Perugia, who in 1951 created an all-steel heel. Then both Ferragamo and Vivier played with the steel heel. And I have argued that the stiletto that you and I might wear today is very much indebted to Vivier's vision, which was one towards great finesse, great refinement, and a kind of slender quality that I don't see in other designers' work. And I think you can see some of that very crisp, very narrow stiletto look in early shoes. This is 1954. So here we're looking at a boot that he made that is really my justification for looking at his work as works of art. Because he made this piece in 1987 when he found out that the Musée de la Mode in Paris was going to do a retrospective of his work. And so he was far on in years, and he decided to do single pieces that incorporated some of the elements, the iconic elements of his designs that had made him famous. Right. And so here you have one of his thigh-high boots, but it's just a single. He never made the other half pair. So there's no way this piece could ever have been worn. It really was meant by him to be looked at as a work of art. So you're able to see a 1960s style that he popularized. You get to see his pyramid heel, wrought large, and you get to see that Dior period decor or embellishment at the top of the boot. And so he brings together different moments of his history, of his career, and creates the single work of art.
To view these works in person, the Vivier exhibition runs until April 7th at the Badishou Museum. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Mar Sellers.
Thank you very much for that, Mar. Still to come in part two of Section D, we'll hear and smell what happened when our Parisian correspondent Tom Burgess Watson got let loose on the rules and tools of fragrance making.
This is my own creation.
And it is definitely really interesting.
We'll also be talking bricks and mortar with Ivan Carvalho at the Bau Construction Trade Fair in Munich. And we'll find out how one canny entrepreneur in Silicon Valley is targeting young girls to get building too. The French capital is undoubtedly still the place to learn the art of making perfume. And it's an art that takes many years to master. If you haven't got years to spend, though, you can still learn some of the basic principles by taking a short course. And with that in mind, we send our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson, to spend an afternoon in the classroom with Stéphanie Bacouche-Couidry, the head of training at the French perfumer L'Artisan Parfumé. As we're about to hear, not only does Tom get taught how a scent is formulated, he also has a go at creating one of his own.
Bonsoir.
Bonjour, messieurs.
Hello, welcome in L'Artisan Parfumeur. We are absolutely going to elaborate your own perfume today. We have a beautiful range of almost 40 perfumes, and we also make some beautiful products for the ambience. So in L'Artisan Parfumeur, you will also find some scented candles, room sprays, and of course our famous ember balls for the house. We offer also this service of perfume workshops where you can either come and just learn about the raw materials and smell some ingredients and understand the job of the perfumer with the initiation workshop, or you can also attend this workshop that you're going to do today, which is the scent of creation workshop to elaborate and create your own perfume. First, we are going to describe together the different parts of a perfume and explain why we talk about top notes, heart notes, and base notes. So just in a few words, it's to explain that the perfume will evolve during the day. It doesn't smell the same when you just apply it and then when it evolves in a few hours and at the end of the day, because the ingredients are composed of different molecules that have different volatility, so they will evaporate at different moment of time. So we will work out your perfume with
a top note, which will really make the freshness, the sparkling freshness of your perfume, and that will not last. And then your perfume will really reach the heart note, which makes the personality of your perfume, where you find all the smells, for example, of the flowers, of the spices, of the fruits. And then during the day, after several hours until the evening, your perfume really develops the base notes, which are the ones thanks to which your perfume will stay on your skin all day long and will bring all the warmth and the sensuality of the fragrance.
So now, to be able to elaborate your own perfume, talk to me a little bit about your relationship with perfumes. How would you talk about the perfume that you like? Do you wear perfume every day? Is it a special product for you for when you go out in the evening? Or tell me a little bit about you.
I think the thing I would like to create today is something interesting and certainly not floral, if that's possible. Something slightly mysterious with a couple of notes of, I don't know, something from the Mediterranean or... Can you help me do that?
Absolutely. Would you like to your perfume to be quite like an eau de toilette, like fresh and sparkling, and you like some quite discreet perfume, not too overwhelming? Or do you think you like more woody, a little bit oriental perfumes, maybe something very long-lasting and very present? Do you like your perfume to leave a sillage when you walk, you know, this stays behind you? Or do you want it to be very delicate, you know? Do you like it to be intimate, or do you like it to be quite present?
Let's say, for argument's sake, something maybe woody, as you mentioned, and slightly oriental. Probably not leaving too much of a vapor trail in every room I go into. I don't know.
Okay.
I think the picture in my mind that's building up is something quite sort of warm and rich as a smell.
So let's get started with the base note, with a selection of the base notes, because definitely, according to what you just told me, it's going to be a very important part of your perfume.
Okay, so we're now in the creating phase, and starting with the base note sounds like a sensible place to begin. That's what the teacher said I should do, so that's what I'm going to do. And I've got my pipette with I've already put in some wood and some musk, and I'm now adding the amber drop by drop. Quite difficult, you've got to count them out.
And that's it.
Okay, all right, so we've added the amber. It smells lovely. Okay.
So now...
we've got the base notes sorted out. What
absolutely.
Are we adding next?
So now you can, for example, add the jasmine.
The jasmine, okay.
Just a little hint, as we said.
All right, a hint of jasmine. So I won't take a full pipette full. And what are we doing after
that? And then we can add the famous rose. That's
like
going to be still very discreet in the perfume, but a little more than jasmine, as we just said.
We're adding the rose. All right, so we've got the rose all sorted out. So we're getting. Am I allowed to sniff it and see how it's going
yes,
so far?
Yes, of course. It's interesting to be able to smell it step by step. Mm. It's very interesting.
It's getting there. Okay. So now, Stefanie, my teacher, we are at the moment of truth, discovering just what my creation actually smells like. And I'm just dipping this in here. This is my own creation.
And it is definitely really interesting.
Interesting.
What's your first impression?
It's a very warm smell. You can smell the basil and the woody notes. I'm quite pleased with my creation. If I'm allowed to be.
You are. And it's very well balanced on your skin. I'm very, very nicely surprised. We don't really have so many adjustments to do. What I like on your skin is that we can really definitely smell something very fresh, you know, with the aromatic and citrus right now. But we immediately feel already that there is something much warmer and enveloping behind that's already very warm and sensual on your skin, actually, and that will smell more and more during the day, you know. But now you really have this balance with the freshness and the warmth at the same time, and I think it fits really well in your skin.
Okay, well, should we try adding a tiny bit, the finishing touch with this, a little bit of cinnamon,
a
couple of drops, isn't it?
It's really a couple of drops, absolutely. So here's the cinnamon.
And the final part of the class is to come up with a name for this.
Well, yes. If you, you know, if you can think of something that it evokes to you, we can, of course, make a nice little label before you leave to label your bottle, your 50 milliliter bottle of perfume you're going to leave with now.
It smells slightly of, it takes me to Sicily. It takes me to the outlying islands in the Mediterranean. Would you be offended if it got an Italian name?
No, I wouldn't. I'm very open-minded.
Okay, let me think of a place in Sicily that I love. Let's go with... how about something like one of those beautiful islands just to the north of Sicily? Stromboli. How about that?
That's a very nice idea for a perfume. We love in L'Artisan Parfumeur to evoke, you know, journeys and, you know, natural evocations from all around the world, so... I'm not going to tell you the opposites. For okay. me, it's very evocative.
So we have created here Eau de Stromboli here with Stéphanie in Paris. That's quite a combination.
Eau de Stromboli. And we print the little label. Et bravo.
Merci.
Thank you very much, Tom. And I have Eau de Stromboli here with me now. A quick spritz. Gosh, it's a little too heavy on the rose, in my humble opinion. Reminds me ever so slightly of my recently departed grandmother. But then I've never been to Stromboli. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald, on Monocle 24. After this brief interlude, we'll be heading to Munich's Messe to hear about the building blocks of the German construction industry. That's more thrilling than it sounds, I promise.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now it's time to switch gears and head to Munich. Every other year in January, the Bavarian capital plays host to BAU, the world's biggest trade fair for building materials. The show attracts a quarter of a million visitors, including 50,000 architects, who attend the week-long event to peruse the stand of 2,000 exhibitors, selling the latest tools and products that go into constructing homes and high-rises. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho visited BAU and built this beautiful report just for us.
Inside Munich's fairgrounds, the BAU Fair covers 25 football fields. Attendees walk the aisles, sizing up thousands of products from skylights and steel beams to the newest nail guns. With 60,000 visitors coming from outside Germany, the event attracts builders, planners, and architects eager to see the might of the host nation and its 80 billion euro construction industry. BAU exhibition director Mirko Arend.
The German building industry and construction industry is definitely very strong. Why? From my point of view, a big advantage is that we have many building companies that are more or less middle-sized companies owned and run by families directly. That's a big advantage, and that's why it's a pleasure for us and an advantage for us. That's why they like trade fairs, to get in contact to other people, because they aren't able, like Siemens or BMW, to build at home sites, for example, in China or in other international regions that are interesting for the building industry. So a trade fair for them is a very good place to get in touch with these customers.
Firms from 40 countries exhibited at BAU, with German businesses accounting for 70% of the stands, each specializing in a sector from wood flooring to door fittings. Ralph Freschmeier of SFB.
FSB is a German manufacturing company. It's in the market since 120 years, more than 120 years, and we are producing high-end lever handles and accessories. And our main materials are out of stainless steel, aluminium, bronze, and brass. We work together with architects and designers, and we always try to find new designs. So means, for example, we work together with Philip Stark, we work together with David Chipperfield or with Christoph Ingenhofen, so with international architects or designers to always try to find alternatives to the standard U and L shape handles, what you can find everywhere. So We are always very happy, and every year we find new handles. So we are also sometimes astonished, but it's like this. Every year we can offer new designs, new handles. Sometimes aluminium as a material is very popular, sometimes stainless steel is popular. Now, since I think 2 years, we are launching bronze handles. Handles really out of massive bronze, and we don't lacquer them or we don't do anything with it. It's really massive bronze, and it's a nature material, and we cast them, and this will also change the finish on the door. So if it's installed on the door, inside or outside, then if you touch more often or less, then it's changing the color. So it's getting more dark or it's getting lighter. So we are playing also with materials.
A popular buzzword at BAU was sustainability. Companies showed off windows able to harness the sun's rays. Eric Richter of Glassmaker Schott.
The Glass X is actually a glass that combines the transparency of glass with a thermal storage capacity of concrete. That means it acts like concrete, but there is a specific light transmission through the glass. So instead of concrete, you can now also use glass. I think the best explanation is when you go to a specific building where we have integrated it. This is in Switzerland, and this is a southern orientated facade where you have in summer problems with the overheating. You see standard clear panels here that act as windows. And if the sun really shines on the facade, they have to shut down a glare protection. So usually the room would be dark then. But here are not standard walls with concrete or wood or other kind of material. Here is really glass X. Although the sun blinds are down, the room gets illuminated by the sun without the problems of overheating. It just stores the energy during the day and avoids overheating for the room. And with the night cooling or out cooling or cooling during the night, it releases the energy when nobody is there.
Over in Hall A5, meanwhile, construction workers perused the newest power tools. Business was brisk at the booth of Liechtenstein-based Hitley. Product manager Andreas Stadler.
What you hear here is our brand new drill hammer TE30 with a hollow drill bit. And also a vacuum cleaner. The vacuum cleaner sucks up the dust inside the drill bit. So you have a clean or brushed hole after using its drilling into concrete.
So you have a very clean work site then?
Absolutely, yes. But not only the work site, also the hole itself is completely clean and you don't have to brush it if you do rebar. So this gives you time savings up to 30-35%. Because you don't have to clean it anymore. So in total on the work site, we have approximately 30-35% time savings. This brand new hollow drill bit is also faster compared to the old traditional way because of its geometry. And nobody else has it in the market.
That was our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho in Munich there at the BAU Construction Trade Fair. You're listening to Section D. In Silicon Valley, technology is for the most part a man's game, with female tech entrepreneurs receiving less than 10% of funding from venture capitalists. A Stanford University engineering graduate called Deborah Sterling thinks part of the problem is that women are discouraged from taking an interest in engineering and science at a young age. Girls get Barbie dolls, while boys are given Lego. Sterling has taken things into her own hands and created Goldie Blocks, a toy that will land in stores in April, and it stars a little girl who loves to build. She tells Monocle correspondent Alistair G why she thinks it will make a difference.
I played with Barbies a little bit. I was not a little engineering kind of girl, but I was very creative. And so growing up, my family, we always used to draw together and do craft projects and that kind of thing.
Where did you get the idea from that it was little girls that you needed to focus on? Why not, for example, discrimination in the workplace?
Well, I think there are many touch points in a girl or woman's life in which they may kind of fall out of the engineering pipeline. And as I was doing my research and thinking about my own experience, I realized that it starts when we're really young, when pop culture, media, and toys kind of tell us that girls are supposed to be princesses and boys are supposed to be builders is really when the issue starts.
Is there much data showing that interventions at this stage in life can make a difference?
There's data that shows that construction toys help develop spatial skills, that kids who played with them score better on spatial skills tests. Boys also tend to score better, and I think that I can make a pretty obvious correlation that more boys play with construction toys than girls do.
You've said that Goldieblocks is something that you want to do for the rest of your life. How did you come across it?
So I was hanging out with a girlfriend, a fellow female engineer, and we were talking about the lack of women in engineering. And she made an argument that growing up as a little girl, playing with her older brother's hand-me-down Legos got her interested in building from a young age. And she argued that the Legos were a huge influence in her life. And I remember thinking, what a shame that Legos are supposed to be this or marketed as this boy's toy, because she's right. They do kind of teach you about math and science and how things fit together. And I went to a toy store the next day and was horrified at what I saw. It was all the cool Legos and math and science stuff in the blue aisle for boys. And the girl aisle was dolls and princesses and pets and static kind of cosmetic beauty parlor stuff. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is insulting to my gender. And I remember from that moment just realizing, oh my gosh, there is this huge gap in the marketplace. There's this huge opportunity to go in and make something that could really make an impact on girls' lives. And here I am. I'm an engineer. I was once a little girl. And I studied product design. I can design a product for little girls. And it just hit me like an epiphany, and I knew it was what I was born to do.
Tell me about the toy itself. What does it look like? How does it work?
So it is a book series and a construction toy combined. So the book stars Goldieblocks, who is a female engineer character. And as you read her story, she goes on adventures with her friends and she encounters problems that she needs to solve by building simple machines. So as you read along, you get to watch Goldie solve her problems by building things, and you get to build the same things along with her using the pieces.
And so you have this story that kids follow along with, and they build stuff. What kind of engineering or spatial principles is this sort of promoting without the girl who's playing it sort of really being that aware of it?
The idea is that Goldieblocks will expand into entire series where each story teaches girls new engineering principles. In the first one, the girls learn to build a belt drive. And in there, they're learning about friction and tension and force. They have to figure out how to put wheels and axles in certain orientations to make their little animal friends spin around. By virtue of reading the book and building the contraption, they're sort of subconsciously learning and understanding how different parts relate to each other and how things work. What I'm working on right now with a bunch of teachers is how to create a corresponding curriculum that parents and teachers could use, so when they're playing the toy with their kids, they can actually explain all of the science behind it.
That's an interesting point, because it strikes me that maybe just playing a single toy isn't enough to make a decisive change, or is it? Do you believe that playing just your toy is enough to send a girl in the right direction towards an engineering degree like yourself?
I think what I'm hoping to achieve, and what I would call a home run, is if Goldieblocks can just create a little spark of interest. The fact that the book itself and the brand is about engineering will teach a 5-year-old girl what the word engineering even is. I didn't know what it was until I was a senior in high school. So imagine how my life would have been different if I had known from a young age, thought engineering was cool and was related to kind of building things and solving problems. And if I had known that engineering was something that could really change the world and make it a better place, I think that I would have wanted to explore it from a much younger age. So it's just about creating an early interest. I think that has the potential to make such a huge impact.
I know that you've done some testing with kids. How have the kids responded to it, and what have you learned from their feedback?
It's been incredible. The main awesome thing that came out of the testing was that the concept of presenting a story about a girl who loves to build really made the girls want to build along too, in a way that the existing construction toys that don't have the narrative component didn't interest them. So the girls wanted to engage, they wanted to be like Goldie, they wanted to do what she did, and they really wanted to build machines that had a function or a purpose or helped someone. So the concept itself was really a home run.
Have you found retail stores who are interested in stocking the product?
We have a ton of interest, and we're in the lucky position where we are picking our partners wisely and getting ready to put Goldieblocks on the shelves of stores in April.
Deborah Sterling, founder of Goldieblocks there, talking to our San Francisco correspondent, Alistair G. And that's all we have time for on today's Section D. Next week, we'll be giving the fashion world a break and taking up the first trade shows of the design industry. We'll be hearing from a Chile Maison et Objet in Paris, a Chilier IMM in Cologne, and the chilliest of all, the Toronto Interior Design Show. Today's show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing you out, here's a song from a lady who I think must love to build, if the title of her song is anything to go by. Here's Kate Nash with Foundations. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
My fingertips are holding on to the cracks in our foundation, and I know that I should let go, but I can't. And every time we fight,